south, including the attack on Baijin. Many view these events as early indicators of a dangerous shift that may eventually demand decisive action.
This regime won't stop at Palestine. It wants full control of the region in order to control all the resources of its people. It has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
This year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Nada Ibrahim, Deir el-Balah City, Palestine.
Again, 120 people were murdered in a massacre by the RSF militia as they attacked a kindergarten, a village, and a hospital. Most of the dead were children aged 3, 4, and 5. The massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also we know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
The UAE are supporter of the RSF rebels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to address its call on the world foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the sixth such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of 8 World Food Program workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza. Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pak-Afghan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relation with other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be important mediator as compared to the other one, being in as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a stakeholder, also having projects with India, being a stake, because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thank you. الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a televised address to the Iranian people on September 23, 2025. My second point is that negotiating with the U.S. in the current situation would bring great harm to the country. And what they want from the negotiations is for Iran to not have uranium enrichment. Now, he's spoken about enrichment. A few days ago, the vice president declared that Iran mustn't have missiles either. Neither long-range missiles, nor medium-range missiles, and not even short-range missiles. He says we, that is Iran, mustn't have any of these. This means they want Iran's hands to be so tied and empty that even if it's attacked, it won't be able to respond or retaliate against a U.S. base in Iraq or anywhere else. That is what this demand means. Should we enter negotiations for such an outcome? Well, that would have no benefit. That would be negotiations where there is no benefit for us. The result of such talks would only be harm for us. That is coercion. That means accepting the U.S.'s coercion and imposition. That isn't negotiations. When one is dealing with Islamic Iran, these kinds of expectations and statements stem from a failure to know the Iranian nation. They stem from a failure to know the Islamic Republic. The reason for this is that they don't know the philosophy, foundations, and guiding principles of Islamic Iran. They talk like this because they don't understand these things. As we, the people of Mashhad, say, this talk is bigger than the mouth that uttered it. And this talk isn't worth paying attention to, this talk of negotiating for such an outcome. So such negotiations would have no benefit for us. Now, as for the harm, I say it has harms, and this is the more important point. The other side has threatened that if we don't negotiate, this and that will happen. They say, we'll bomb you, or we'll do this and that. There are threats of this nature. Some are vague, and others are stated bluntly. They say, either negotiate, or if you don't, this and that will happen. This is a threat. Well, accepting such negotiations would signify that the Islamic Republic of Iran is susceptible to threats. If you go and enter negotiations after such threats, it would mean that in the face of any threat, we are immediately frightened, tremble, and surrender to the opposing side. That is what it would mean.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
I want to thank you for all the things.
Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For years, they lecture the world on the rules-based international order, on property rights, on legal sovereignty, on the sanctity of law. Now, in a move of hypocrisy, the European Union, under the heavy hand of Washington, has simply stolen what is not theirs, $246 billion. Russian sovereign assets seized frozen under a fabricated, quote, emergency. They dress this theft in the language of morality, of supporting Ukraine, but do not be fooled. This is an act of economic warfare, a desperate escalation by a failing bloc tearing up its own legal scriptures to serve a master across the Atlantic. It has shattered European unity with its own members crying rape of law, and it has been promised with a fierce and justified retaliation from Moscow. In this Spotlight episode, we cut through the Western propaganda. We ask, who truly ordered this? How deep are the cracks in Brussels? And is this the final foolish blow to any chance of peace? But first, let's get more details in this report.
The European Union has indefinitely frozen Russia's assets in Europe over the Ukraine war. Using a special procedure meant for economic emergencies, the bloc's governments agreed to immobilize $246 billion. Worth of Russian sovereign assets until Moscow ends the war and compensates its neighbor for the damage caused in the conflict. It's a key step that will allow EU leaders to work out at a summit next week how to use the tens of billions of euros in Russian central bank assets to underwrite a huge loan to help Ukraine meet its financial and military needs over the next 2 years. The move has caused rifts within the EU. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban slammed the decision, accusing the European Commission, which prepared the measure, of, quote, systematically raping European law. He said the move means the rule of law in the European Union comes to an end, and Europe's leaders are placing themselves above the rules. Slovakia has also criticized the measure, warning that the use of frozen Russian assets could directly jeopardize efforts to end the Ukraine war. Russia's central bank, meanwhile, said it has filed a lawsuit in Moscow against Euroclear, a Belgian financial group that holds the majority of Russian assets. In a separate statement, the central bank also described wider EU plans to use Russian assets to aid Ukraine as illegal and contrary to international law, arguing that they violated the principles of sovereign immunity of assets. Russian officials have also repeatedly said that tapping the frozen assets would be met with the harshest reaction. The legal battle over frozen funds is taking place as the United States pushes for a ceasefire deal between Moscow and Kyiv. A draft U.S. peace plan released last month envisioned using the frozen funds for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. As a result, They're used by European leaders for a loan before a peace deal could cause tension with Washington. But European officials say the alternative is for Ukraine to face a financial crunch. Analysts believe the asset freeze reveals that the bloc is willing to bend its own rules when politically convenient, eroding the very legal order it claims to uphold and exposing deep fractures within the bloc.
On this episode, we are joined by Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joining us from Florida, U.S. And Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Mr. Doctorow, let's go ahead and start off with you. Let's start off with this whole legitimacy on the so-called economic emergency procedure, as they're calling it. Now, some people are describing it as a not-so-simple legal loophole, while others are calling it outright theft of a sovereign nation's sovereignty. I mean, what side would you lean to? Obviously, what's in front of us of basically this over these hundreds of billions of euros, of dollars, excuse me, being stolen by the EU?
Well, let's take this in two steps. What happened on Friday was step one. That is that Ursula von der Leyen put before the member states of the European Union a proposal to end the six-monthly renewals of sanctions against Russia, which had within it the freezing of assets. That was done as a first measure to prepare the way for collateralization of a large loan, a loan in the amount of 145 billion euros, to be paid out in two annual portions of 45 billion each, and the remainder to be used to pay off a G7 loan to Ukraine that has fallen due. Now, step one, I say, because if the frozen assets could be ordered released as a result of failure at the six-month intervals to find unanimity and to continue the sanctions, then that would vitiate the basis for having these funds held in collateral. To avoid that, in the anticipation that at least one member state, namely Hungary, would at some point veto the extension by 6 months, they put this to a vote, and von der Leyen won. But I say this is only step one, and it's procedural. It was simply to put in place the holding of those assets, and with the purpose of their being removed from the grips of Mr. Trump, and thereby giving leverage to the European Union in the ongoing negotiations over peace, from which it has been sidelined. So I see the principal importance of what happened yesterday, which was approved, and was even approved by Belgium, which has been the most vocal opponent of the whole notion of collateralization for purposes of a loan to Ukraine. It passed because it is dealing with securing a place at the negotiating table for Europe. Period. The big issue, and which is completely uncertain how voting will go and procedurally how von der Leyen will handle it, is still ahead. That's when the European Council, which is the second executive body of the European institutions, whereas the European Commission is the executive carrying out the daily activities of acting as a cabinet. The European Council meets on big issues. It meets once a month, and it consists of the 27 heads of state or heads of government of the European Union.
Yes, it and Mr. Doctorow, if you don't mind me cutting you off right there, I would like to go ahead and bring in our guest from the U.S., of course, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for your patience. Mr. Johnson, let's talk a bit about, I mean, basically they violate the principle of the sovereign asset immunity. Now, what precedent has the West now actually even put into play? I mean, does what stops any other nation at this moment from seizing any European, any American assets in the future under their own declared, quote, emergencies, or would that even be different in the European or the Americans' own eyes as not acceptable because it's them being attacked here?
Well, this has the potential to set off a whole chain reaction. In fact, we started to see it with Russia has now filed a lawsuit against Euroclear. I believe it's in a Russian court, but Russia was prepared, for this step. Russia has the potential to seize a variety of European assets. They've avoided doing so because the Russians, in contrast to the Europeans, are much more committed to trying to uphold international law. But all of this, I think, is taking place in the context of we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the international economic order that was established at the end of World War II. Then the United States has been the de facto leader of that for the last 80 years. But now with the rise of BRICS, with the increased cooperation between Russia and China, we're seeing that that whole system starting to unravel, because the ability of the West to use economic, financial terms as a bludgeon, as a coercive lever over other states is starting to slip. Recall that it was 10 years ago that Russia and China agreed with the West to impose sanctions on Iran. And now, in the wake of the snapback sanctions, Russia and China both said, nah, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to support Iran. So this is a last desperate play by the Europeans. And frankly, in the whole context of the war in Ukraine, it's not going to make one bit of difference.
And Mr. Doctor, I mean, let's move over a bit to these EU rifts, to this hypocrisy being taking place at the moment. Analysts are saying that this reveals that the EU bends its rules when politically convenient. But doesn't this finalize the bloc's transformation from, let's say, a community of law to a mere geopolitical tool for Washington, or has it always been a tool for Washington, in your opinion?
Head of the facts. I told you about step one. Step one doesn't violate anything. It's simply enshrines in perpetuity what exists until now on a six-month basis. The Russian assets have not been touched. The Russian assets will not be touched when they meet on the 18th and 19th. These are separate issues, but it's very important to make distinctions here to understand why people are voting the way they are. The second step would happen on the 18th and 19th of December, and that is to invoke the same principle of qualified majority, not at unanimity, to vote on the principle of using these assets to open a loan to Ukraine. That already is the point where the assets are touched. Now, as regards the danger of this, it's not just a question of hollow hypocrisy and saying that the European Union doesn't live up to the standards. There's something much more important going on here, and it could lead to the collapse of the global financial system. My colleague has said correctly that the Russians have put a legal action against the holdings that are in Russia and owned by Euroclear. So it's not just the Russians had deposited one way into Euroclear, but Euroclear also keeps deposits with those countries that it deals with. And the Russians are now saying, much more important than the 18 billion euros in Euroclear assets that the Russians can seize at any time they want, more important than that, the Russians are issuing an announcement to the global community to seize Euroclear assets wherever they are. Now, what does this mean, and what is Euroclear? Belgium is a small country, and people would think, but normally, that Euroclear is small also. Wrong. Euroclear has $43 trillion in assets under its care. If that starts to wind out, if there is an attack on its assets, which put its financial well-being in jeopardy, then the whole system unravels and you have a global financial crisis. So what Mrs. New speak about the Europeans, let's be very specific. This is an initiative coming from very few people who are usurpers of power, who are essentially dictators. And the dictator number one is Ursula von der Leyen. She is the one who hatched this idea and is pursuing it with a vengeance. So before we pin the blame on the whole of Europe, you have to look at who is actually the agent of this crime.
Well, as you did point out there, Mr. Doctor, the situation is definitely more deeper than anyone is expecting. We have to look at the financial part. We have to see the history behind this. Mr. Johnson, I mean, I know we've seen a lot of your analysis on other shows and, of course, everything that you do. I would like to get your opinion on the situation, the significance of the timing specifically about this so-called economic emergency procedure. Is it have any relation to the very fast advancements by the Russian forces there on the ground, in your opinion, or does it have nothing to do with it?
No, no, it absolutely does. And as Gil correctly noted, I mean, this is an act of utter desperation by the Europeans. It just shows how they don't have any other playbook to go to, because the advance of Russia right now is so comprehensive, so sweeping, and so fast that there is literally nothing that the Europeans can do. Even if they quote were going to mobilize to send troops to the Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainians, it'd be months trying to get their act together on that front. And Gil correctly notes that this poses the potential to unravel the Western-dominated financial system. Because once you destroy faith in an institution's ability to protect your assets, people start going elsewhere. And ultimately, it is the belief that they're going to follow the law, that they're not going to play personal politics. I mean, for goodness sakes, during World War II, my understanding is even though Western banks held financial assets of Nazi Germany that the West was at war with, they still protected those assets. And now here, and just to give you some measure of the desperation, they're willing to throw all of that aside. And again, it would be one thing if they could say, well, if we take that $300 billion, by God, that's going to stop the Russian advance, and it's going to actually force them to retreat. That's not the case.
Well, with that, Mr. Doctor, I mean, you were talking a moment about who is at fault here. The funds are meant to, quote, as they mentioned, underwrite a loan to Ukraine. Is Europe essentially making the Ukrainian people indebted for decades? I mean, they're coming over money that isn't even theirs to give. How is this going to affect the Ukrainians?
You know, the wording of this loan does not envisage the kind of threat to Ukrainians' interest that you are raising now. It states that the loan falls due at the moment that the Russians pay for the damage they've caused. And the Russians will never pay for the damage they've caused because they're the winners of this war. So this is why it is a transparent confiscation of assets. But the Ukrainians as such will receive the money, will spend the money, will steal the money, and will have no obligation to repay. That is inherent in this deal. Everyone is talking on two sides of their mouth. Mr. De Weber has been extremely brave in risking the wrath of all of the other 26 member countries, 25 member countries, because Hungary certainly would not be angry at what he's doing. But he has gone up against almost all of his colleagues and said in his declaration that was issued yesterday by four countries, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, and Malta. They all said in voting for that waiver of the unanimous voting procedure yesterday, but we can be sure they will not approve application of the same limited majority when it comes up for a vote on applying for a loan against this on the 18th and 19th. Mr. De Weber made firm statements that he supports Ukraine to the end. That's what he says to the European Commission, to look like one of the boys. When he speaks in Belgium, as he did last week, he spoke in French to a gathering in one of the major auditoriums in the center of the city. He said something quite different, that the idea that Ukraine could win this war is a fairy tale and an illusion. He also said to the editor of the major French-speaking newspaper in this town that for Russia to lose this war is not a good idea, considering it's the world's biggest nuclear power. You follow with the dots lead. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and it's very risky to make facile generalizations about what European leadership thinks. But I think the real issue, when Mr. De Weber and his three colleagues said that they oppose the use of the Russian assets for purposes of a loan, they said, oh, we could do something more constructive. We can give a European loan out of our own pockets for that money. He's saying that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that no European country other than Germany is willing to pony up 2 euros to help Ukraine because they'd have to go to their parliaments. That is the real trick here. This, von der Leyen has done, is to count on the violation of democracy across the whole of the EU, not just in parliament, which she oversees, because it means that money will be put up by European governments without going to their parliaments.
Well, exactly, and Mr. Doctorow, as you did mention, I'd like to thank you for clarifying those points in our procedure. As we were mentioning, sometimes we've got to make it very clear to the viewers what is actually meant behind the scenes, behind the ink on the paper, if we may. Mr. Johnson, we have around 4 to 5 more minutes. Let me go ahead and get in a few more questions, if we could. Let's just focus a moment on this Russian response / retaliation. They said that it's going to be harsh. Now, they promised this. What kind of form could we perhaps expect other than what they did to there in Russia? Are we looking at symmetrical seizures of remaining Western assets in Russia, or are we perhaps maybe something asymmetrical, economic, maybe a diplomatic warfare? What are you expecting? What kind of reaction from Russia?
Well, Russia is going to follow, they're going to follow legal procedure. They're not going to act recklessly. They're certainly not going to react emotionally. And we saw the first step of it with the legal action, the filing of the suit against Euroclear that was taken, I believe, yesterday. Going forward, if the Europeans actually move ahead and seize assets, the Russians have made provisions to seize European assets that are still in Russia. And what's interesting is, despite now 3, going on almost 4 years of war, and several provocations, continued provocations by the West, particularly by Europe, Russia has not gone after those assets because they still put value in the notion of doing things legally, trying to uphold international law, and trying to ensure that there's some sort of order in the system. It's the West that has continually been walking away from agreements and violating the laws. As you said in your opening, it's almost like, it's the golden rule. Those with the gold get to make the rules. And from the United States standpoint, they said, well, we got all the gold, so we're going to make the rules. And that turns out not to be the case. But, I think Russia's well prepared to retaliate, but they're going to do it unemotionally and legally.
Well, Mr. Doctorow, with the last few minutes, I'd like to go ahead and direct my last question towards you. We have to bring up this draft peace plan being brought up by the U.S. Now, they envisioned it using frozen assets for post-war reconstruction, according to them. By jumping the gun, basically, and using them now for this war funding, has Europe just sabotaged Washington's own peace roadmap, or is everything we see planned? Was there even a peace plan at the beginning?
No, you just identified the logic. It's to sabotage the American peace plan.
And with that, I do have just one more question. If you could each answer it in around 30 to 40 seconds, your own words. Ultimately, how will this actually accelerate the global move away from the dollar, the euro-dominated assets, towards alternatives, perhaps among the BRICS nations, around others, who are wary of the Western financial weaponization? For 30 seconds, please, Mr. Johnson, in your own words.
Yeah, well, it's a further reaffirmation that the West is not to be trusted, that the West is a bully, and that they're going to use whatever economic leverage they have over them. So therefore, the global South, Russia and China, they're moving as quickly as they can to separate themselves from that.
And Mr. Doctorow, your answer, please.
The bottom line is the pitch that the advertiser of a talk show, both Larry Johnson and I participate in, my goal.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. From Florida, USA, Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and of course, as always, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst there, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. A pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye.
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.